You're listening to Alternative Future Radio, home of the weird, resting place of the paranormal. We'll take you to the furthest reaches of the galaxy and beyond. Strange phenomena, aliens, psychics, cryptozoology, conspiracy, holistic health, and UFOs. Alternative Future Radio, where spooky just got weird.
Good morning, campers, and welcome to the Out There Hour. Sometimes we go out there, but yet somehow remain curiously grounded. Confused? You will be.
The Out There Hour on Alternative Future Radio. The Out There Hour with Basil and Mark. www.alternativefutureradio.com.
Yay!
Well,
good morning.
Good evening.
Good afternoon.
To America.
Africa.
The Middle East.
Asia.
And maybe Australia.
Australia. And that little island in the
Polynesia.
Pacific with the red phone box.
Yes, that one.
I lied. And it's got a post office.
Oh, now it's got a post office. You're elaborating on your story now.
Good morning, the world.
Good morning to everybody, and welcome to the Out There Hour. We've got an interesting show today and a very interesting guest. I've been quite giddy about this guest, actually. He's very, very interesting.
I think this man is going to be absolutely...
huge.
Majorly important.
He isn't very well known.
No, not at all.
But he really should be. Because he is someone with not only an alien contact, would you call it abduction? Probably not, more contact.
It's contact.
Story, which in itself is pretty amazing.
From the age of three.
And yeah,
he has vivid memories of it.
But then, as we're hopefully going to discover today, his family connections are all... really, really important and very, very interesting.
He's got a grandfather and a mother in service of...
Secret services of some description.
MI6 and MI5.
Yeah.
And the story with his mother is that she did a lot of the work at home.
Yeah.
So you need to listen to this very carefully.
Yeah.
She left a lot of files lying around.
And he read them as a kid.
And he read them, and he's telling us about them today.
Yeah.
What was in those files.
He's had at least, an attempt on his life.
Yes,
and I can imagine why, based on what I've heard.
Really interesting story, that one.
Simon
Parkes has hit the headlines.
He's in national papers.
Anything from The Guardian to The Huffington Post.
Yeah, he's been all over the place, but yet still remains not that well known in that community.
He's a local councillor, Labour councillor.
Yeah.
Now,
this is the beauty. Normally, you would say somebody, he's an alien contactee, is he drunk or on drugs, or, is he a professional media student or somebody who you might be more suspicious of? This guy's about as grounded as it gets.
Yeah, and he's got a lot to lose by talking about this.
He's gained nothing.
Nothing to gain, everything to
lose. As far as I know, he's not got a book for sale. He's not even got a website. He basically tells his story, and from what I can see, it does him no financial favours at all.
No.
The Labour Party, of which he's assumably a member if he's a councillor for them,
he is.
They can't be that pleased that he's out there telling the story.
We must stress again, he's had access to secret government files that are very revealing.
Yeah.
Anybody with an interest in UFOs?
Yep. Nazis?
Nazis, or even time travel.
Yeah. It's got it all, really, to be fair.
And it's almost like an end of a season finale for us in the Out There Hour, because it's tying up many loose ends that we've got.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Going right back to Gerard Williams, all the way up to some of the disclosure people, he ties the whole lot together.
Yeah, he's the missing piece of the jigsaw.
Shall we do it?
Yeah, let's do it. This is going to be huge.
I think so. I hope so. Anyway, and I suspect we're going to have him on more than once because his story is pretty epic.
I want to get him on very quickly because I don't want anything to happen to him.
Right, shall we do it?
Let's do it.
What's coming first?
Let's have an advert.
Have you always been interested in the esoteric world? Perhaps you'd like to learn more about ufology, lost civilizations, cryptozoology, or even conspiracy theories. We have diploma courses in all these subjects and more, and our tutors are all experts in their fields. So, if you want to become an expert or just have a great time learning about exopolitics, false flag terrorism, or the paranormal, then the Esoteric Academy is the place for you. EsotericAcademy.com, where ideas and learning meet.
You should probably help support this station by buying the new Alternative Future Radio Android application. You can download all the latest programs or the archived shows, and it's just $1.99. PayPal will bill you in your usual currency if you don't use dollars. Find out more at AlternativeFutureRadio.com.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, so hopefully now on the line we should have, as long as the line holds up, Simon Parks from Whitby, United Kingdom, and I believe Whitby is still classed as Yorkshire, so the traditional greeting, A-up, Simon.
Well, you did really well there. Mark, it's lovely to speak to you and to Basil and to all your listeners.
Simon, thank you so much for coming on, because we have great difficulty with contactees or abductees or whatever you want to call it. Mm. Some people think that anybody who talks about this is out for attention. It's actually quite the opposite. They really don't want to. They don't want the attention. They don't want to be speaking on these kind of programs at all. So we very much appreciate you.
We've even had a few people cancel over the months and things, you know. So I mean,
they book and they get cold feet pretty quickly.
That's not the hallmark of an attention seeker, shall we say? Which I think is the usual counter argument. Anyway,
shall we start with the press coverage of Simon and the extraordinary headline?
Yeah.
A local politician. My mother was an alien. This is how it's been presented.
Really?
Yes. So you're basically, Simon, you're a Labour councillor in Whitby.
Yes.
And you're a driving instructor, are you?
That's right, yes.
Ah. Where do we start with this story, Simon? Because Basil and I have both seen some of your previous interviews, and some of them are quite long. It's a very big... detailed story. And where do we start with this? Do you want to start, I suppose, with your earliest memories forward?
I think something, before we get to the earliest memory, I think what's quite interesting is there's a bit of a background with Simon, with his mother and even his grandfather in the, what would you call it?
Secret Service
surveillance agencies, that kind of thing. Can you tell us something about that, Simon, about what your mother did?
Yes, definitely, Basil, but I'll just go back to the question that you sort of asked but didn't. the reason that I'm prepared to go live in public with this, because when I first became fully aware of what was going on to me, I looked around for help, and there was nothing in Britain at all. So I approached MUFON in America, and everyone was saying to me, "Oh, they won't take you because you're in Britain." And some people said, "Watch it," because they were set up by the CIA. Frankly, I didn't care. All I wanted to do was just to talk to people who, you know, had similar experiences.
Yeah.
And they did take me, and I was with them for 8 months on the 24-hour support network, and I found that very helpful. I also did agree to do some videos for Amash, which are on YouTube. It's primarily because I want other people who experience and don't know where to turn to have a focal point, so that in the case of the YouTube videos, they've got Amash's phone number.
Yeah.
So the reason I've gone public is firstly because I wanted to offer support to the thousands of people throughout the world who are in my position. But I also wanted to tell people, do you know what? Your government's lying to you. Mm. So those are the reasons that I'm prepared to do this and go public.
And what's the reaction been like in your local community?
How did amazing.
Just wondering.
Yeah. When a prominent local newspaper phoned me,
yes,
the very first piece of press interest, which was a year after I'd done the Amash videos, and it was to do with another incident, which we might come on to a bit later. Mm-hmm. I'd already been tipped off by a friend who was ex-intelligence service, who said that a prominent Mason who owned a newspaper wanted to politically destroy me. So when this phone call came through, I was prepared for it. And he actually asked me the question, do you stand by your YouTube videos? And that was the point, you know, Mark and Basil, that was the point I could have said, no, I don't, or I'm going to put the or no comment. But I wanted to be true to myself and true to my experiences, and that's why that I said yes, I do. And although I've had some flack, people locally have come up to me and said, "Well, someone's got the guts to come out and say it." Yeah. So I'm actually being really heartened by the support that I've had, and then all the other media interest. They weren't out to do a destruction story on me. They were just out for the story. So in actual fact, it got the message out 10 times better than it would have done if they'd just left me alone.
I've read articles from The Guardian to The Huffington Post, and I must say, it wasn't bad. They weren't dismissing you. It
wasn't too much of an attack piece or anything.
It wasn't an attack at all, no. They just stated, as Simon had stated it, which was very,
unusual of them, I would have to say.
It's unusual. It's surprising. It was very balanced.
They have a problem because I'm a politician, albeit I'm a local politician. Yeah. They have a problem in debunking me because I am officially elected. So it's difficult for them how to tread. So it's given them a hard time. Listen, I know we're short of time, so I'll quickly go on to the next question.
Simon, thank you.
My grandfather,
yes.
I don't go too long on this because it is really, 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 it's very interesting, but it's a long story.
Okay.
My grandfather... in 1930, was invited to join at what was we call it MI6. Mm. I don't know what it was called back then, but it was the version of the Foreign Security Service. Mm. And in the family, we never referred to it as MI6. It was always called as Grandpa's Appointment.
Mm-hmm.
Also, at the same time, was made a British consul for the embassy in Pondicherry in India. And he was told that because you're a British consul now, you can go all over the world and you can deal with whatever, and no one will ask any questions because you'll have diplomatic immunity. And back in those days, we're talking about the early 1970s, mm-hmm. I didn't know what the word Illuminati meant.
Mm.
I do now. And my grandfather told me, well, I'll recount it to you because it's fascinating. Mm. Whatever stories you might have heard regarding the then king, and I think we're talking about Edward VIII, had an affair with Wallis Simpson and wanted to marry her.
Yeah.
Well, when I was 21 years of age, my grandfather considered that I was a man, not 18. You had to be 21 with Grandpa.
Mm-hmm.
And he banished his wife, and he sat me down for 2 hours, and he told me some very interesting things, which he never repeated. But basically, the Prime Minister of the day didn't feel he had the guts to get rid of the king. So his advisors said to him, why don't you form a jury of 12 good men and true and ask them whether the king should remain or not? My grandfather was one of the 12 who was chosen. He was based in India at the time. He got an early message, an early telex, something very early, but not a telegram, but something electronic. And Grandpa said to me that messages in those days had to be kept extremely short because codes could be broken. And the message said, should the king go or stay? And I said to Grandfather, well, what did you send back? And he said, go. And I said, well, what was the vote? And he said, 10 voted that the king had to go, 2 had to stay. So I said, well, Grandpa, why did you come to that view? And he said, because Special Branch, interestingly enough, not the security service, Special Branch had told the British government that Wallis Simpson was not a German agent in the sense of like James Bond, but she was having a love affair with the head of the German mission in London and was passing documents across. And there was an organization called the Golden Circle, which was an affiliation of the very highest in the land. We're talking about landed gentry with senior Nazis. And the plan was to turn the British government over on itself and to allow the landed gentry to take control of Britain with the Daily Mail newspaper, I might add.
Yes.
This was the plan. That's why Hess actually flew. To Scotland, but it was too late by then.
Mm.
But the Special Branch were the ones that had warned the British government, because in 1936 Britain had started rearming. So what was fascinating was that at the time I just thought, oh, my grandfather, what a important man. Well, now, for God's sake, you know, I realised that one of the 12 men in the whole world who could say king stayed or goed.
Mm.
So now I realize now what an incredibly powerful man he was. He was a Mason, but he bought himself out. He was awarded the OBE, the MBE, the CBE. He was offered a knighthood, which he turned down. They said to him, we can't give you a pension because we don't want to tie you to the British government at all. So what we'll buy you large numbers of stocks and shares. You choose the company.
Yeah.
Grandfather, Rolls-Royce Engines. So they bought him thousands of pounds worth of stocks and shares in Rolls-Royce Engines to keep him sweet. Yeah. And then they appointed him to the United Nations, and he represented Britain on the cotton industry because he knew a lot about cotton, having been in India. Mm-hmm. So he was an incredibly powerful man. And his daughter, my mother, ended up working for MI5. I'll take a break there for a minute.
Certainly. But, my goodness, it's
that's a hell of a hell of a story.
It sure is. Even despite the main story, that's rather a story in itself.
I seem to remember that Edward VIII, there was lots of rumours. I think I've got the right one. He was the one who was believed to be quite Nazi friendly.
Yes,
wasn't he? Was he extracted from somewhere in Europe by MI5, or was that just a plan they had? I think I saw a film about it, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think he was in France or somewhere like that, and I think he was.
He was sympathetic.
Yeah,
to them.
And they were trying to get him back.
You're breaking.
Oh, we're breaking up.
Oh, we're breaking up. Oh, dear.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Breaking up a little bit, yeah. I can still hear you, but it's just breaking up a bit.
Yeah.
Probably because of the subject matter.
Very strange.
Considering what we're talking about.
I was just saying, Edward VIII was known to be somewhat sympathetic to the Nazi cause.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. In fact, when the king abdicated, Special Branch, who were tailing Simpson, thought that she was actually going to make a runner to Germany.
Yeah. He was actually in Europe, wasn't he? Meeting with very senior Nazis. I'm not sure if he met Hitler, did he?
He did. He did meet Hitler, absolutely, with her as well. Mm. Yes, both of them met him.
Yeah.
And that was all arranged by Ribbentrop. That was the name that Grandfather said.
Ah. Now, was he extracted from Europe? Was he sort of brought back to England and bundled away somewhere? Or did he come back of his own volition? I have a vague recollection of a plot to extract him.
That I don't know. I can only tell you what my grandfather has told me, and he didn't mention anything about that at all.
Yeah, very interesting. So you were up to the point with your mother, and she was in MI5, I think you said.
Yes, sir.
Yes. what happened was that she worked in a patent office.
Mm.
I'm sure you know what a patent office is.
Yep.
And there was one guy there who was a freelance, and he used to come and go into the office quite a lot. And he was quite well known, and he would come to the house sometimes and talk about work. On one occasion, the doorbell went. This would be in about 1971. So I would be about 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So it's three years before you were born, Mark.
Yeah.
And the doorbell goes, and I open the door, and it's this guy, Paul, and another guy. And I know it's going to sound really, really cliche, but yes, he was. He was there with a white shirt, a black tie, black sunglasses, black suit. Mm-hmm. I'd never seen him before, but I knew Paul. So I said, come in and call Mum. And Mum came and said, hello, Paul. And Paul said, this man wants to talk to you. And the guy looks at my mother and says, get rid of the kid. So Mum says to me, oh, go and play outside. Well, I'm not quite so easily got rid of. So it was we lived in a flat, which was divided from a big house. And they were very Victorian. It was about 1890. So it was quite big. There was a bloody great big keyhole in the door. And I just went outside and peeped through the keyhole. And I could see quite clearly, and I could hear quite clearly. And the guy brought out some papers, some documents, and said to my mother, sign these. And my mother said, well, what are they? And the guy said, just sign them. Now, mother was a single parent, and she was quite feisty. You had to be back in those days, otherwise if you were a single parent, you didn't survive. So she said, no, I'm not signing something that I don't know what it's about. So this went backwards and forwards. And in the end, mother said, well, I'm calling the police. And the man went immediately and sat on the sofa and said, good, because they'll make you sign it. And at that point, my mother, I think, realized that there was something quite serious and out of her depth. So Paul Dunlop, that's his name, because I'll give you that, because he said he wasn't his real name. Paul Dunlop said to my mother, look, for God's sake, Jean, said, you love your country, don't you? Yes. You want to help your country, don't you? Yes. You want to earn two wages? And she said, what do you mean two wages? He said, well, you can carry on working at the patent office and you will draw your salary once a week, but you won't have to go in and work there. And once a month, I'll come and pay you as well. And he said, you know, two wages, you're bringing up a boy on your own. That would be really handy, wouldn't it? So mother signed. And then the man said immediately, you've now signed the Official Secrets Act. You have been cleared to an extremely high level. If you tell anybody about today or about the work you do for us, you will be found on a railway line. Then who will look after your kid? With that, he walked out the door. And I sort of dived into the bedroom. Then when he'd gone, I came back and listened. And Mum was just asking lots of questions to try and check it wasn't a joke. And it was quite seriously organised. And then Paul Dunlop went out the room and I went in the garden quickly, found a branch and then sort of went into the front room waving this branch as a sort of a, I've been in the garden playing to try and prove. But my mother just, she had just sitting there just staring and she, you know, I could have come in dressed as a clown and she wouldn't have noticed. So that's how my mother got into to MI5.
How strange. What did she do in MI5 or for them? Do you know?
After signing the act.
Oh, yes, I do know, because she worked from home. They had her desk and her typewriter. This is before computers were in the civil side, brought to the house. And what would happen was that Paul Dunlop was a translator. The reason his name is Paul Dunlop, he said, this is not my real name. He had his own private aeroplane. He had a Formula 2 racing car, and he had two or three MG sports cars for his daily use. And he said to my mother, I was in the room, that's not my real name. I took my name off a tyre. All that rubber around, it must have just jumped out at him. The thing that I never really picked up when I was younger, but UFO researchers have since said to me, is they're just absolutely amazed that he and others would come into the flat and hold discussions, and I would never be asked to leave. The only time I was asked to leave was when my mother signed the Official Secrets Act documents.
Ah.
All the other times, as a small boy, I'd be playing with my Scalectrics or my soldiers or on the floor on the carpet.
Yeah.
And they would just sit there and talk UFO, aliens, Nazi technology, everything in front of me. And every time I would look up, they would look at me and smile. And now, now as people have said to me, don't you think that's odd? And at the time, I accepted it. So, okay, what would happen is Dunlop would turn up with German documents. These were larger than A4. They were never white. They were cream-coloured. Depending on the importance of the document, they would either have, if they weren't very important, they would have a red seal about the size of a teacup.
Simon, can I just get a time check on that? This is obviously when you were a child. So these are German documents well after World War II. They're supposedly friendly at this stage.
Oh, they are. These are what I understand them to be. Operation Paperclip. Lots of German scientists did not want to go to America, wanted to stay in what became West Germany.
Yeah.
But what people don't know is that they were never managed by the West German government. The Bundesrepublik never managed them. It was MI5 from, 1947, maybe even a little bit earlier than that, 46, right through to the 1980s. MI5 managed the German scientists. And the Bundesrepublik, all it was allowed to do was stamp its eagle on all the documents so that they had comfort. They had felt that they'd had the say. But in reality, And the reason it had to be was because had they gone over to West German citizenship officially, they would have had to be tried for Nazi crimes.
But
they were run by MI5. They were considered for a foreign government and couldn't be tried. So these documents would, if they weren't very important, they would have a red paper seal. It looks like a wax seal, but it was just red paper. And they would have the words confidential in red ink stamped on the top. Then the other ones would have the word secret stamped on the top in red ink. Then there was top secret. then there was very top secret, and the big buggers of the case, which set everybody's on edge, were in purple ink, extremely top secret. And they are referred to as the Purple Group. And my mother, who used to swear very frequently, and I won't swear now for you, but every time one of those would come, she would say, "Oh, no, not another purple F-U-C-K-E-R."
Yeah.
And every time we had a purple F-U-C-K-E-R that she had to work on at home, there would be a GPO, post office van, would sit outside 24 hours a day watching. So what would happen is that Paul Dunlop would bring these documents, and he would have translated them into English on an old voice tape, an audio tape, which Mother plugged in and played back through headset. And as Paul Dunlop spoke a sentence from German into English, she typed the English. And she did this 7 days a week. Monday to Friday, I was at school, but Saturday and Sunday, I was at home. Mm. And the routine, every lunchtime, my mother would finish typing, leave the document on the table, go into the kitchen, make food. She never ate with me. In all the years that I lived with her, we never ate together. She would never eat with me. So she would come through, she gave me my food, and then she'd go into the kitchen. But what I used to do was go and read the documents. So, and I would hear a footfall coming up the hall, so I knew to stop. So between 1971 and 1979, when I could, I used to read what she typed. And this is the process. And what would happen, every 3:30 every Friday, she would walk to, and the company is called GF Redfern & Co., and it was the Pant office in Brighton on the London Road. They've moved to Worthing now in Sussex. And she would walk across Preston Park at 3:30. She'd go into the reception, sign her name, get a wage packet, and walk out again. But this is where a contact would walk past her and tell her what day she had to be ready take the document, because when Paul Dunlop gave her the document, he would cut the ribbon. There was a ribbon that went round it, and he signed it in the top right-hand corner. She then had to sign in the top right-hand corner. It was no longer his responsibility. It was her responsibility. So when she'd finished typing it out into English, a green Jaguar Mark II would pull up outside. She would quickly walk out, and she would pass code words with the driver, not the driver, the front seat passenger. She'd get her. She then would be a copy of the Financial Times on the back seat. She put her document inside the Financial Times. She was driven to Brighton Central Railway Station. She had to get out, and she walked to the London platform. She bought a platform ticket, which I think was 2p back then, and she'd sit on the first bench. And it was about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so it wasn't rush hour. And then gentlemen in a bowler hat, pinstripe suit, red carnation, umbrella, and a copy of the Financial Times under his arm would come along, sit next to her, and they would have code words. And I know what some of them were, because it doesn't matter now because it's old ago. It would be something like, "It's a long way to Littlehampton." And then the reply might be, "Well, it's raining there now." And then what would happen is that he would put his copy of the Financial Times down. She would take a copy and just do a swap. So he would pick the document in, you get straight back on the London train off to London. Now, just to wrap this up, over a period of months, Mother was asking questions of Paul Dunlop and not getting a lot of answers. But the answers that she did get was that, yes, you do work for MI5, but really you're working for the NSA. It's the Americans that run the show, but because we have an agreement with them, MI5 is fronting it. So MI5 fronts it up. But this document goes back to London and to America. And apparently the paperclip scientists in America were absolutely worked off their feet. And when stuff they couldn't cope, then it went to this group of ex-Nazi scientists in West Germany. The documents were everything from all about crash after retrieval. There was never any date when this stuff came down. There was no explanation as to how it was brought down or where it crashed. The documents followed the same format. They were given a piece of technology and they were asked, what is it? How does it work? What application militarily can we make of it? And all these documents followed this rationale. This is how they were laid out. And there was everything from nuclear reactors to energy weapons to time travel to loads and loads on computers, miniaturizing, it's all about conductors, semiconductors, superconductors, trying to get computers smaller and smaller and smaller. The sad thing about all this is that my mother couldn't cope with what she was reading. She couldn't, she just couldn't manage it. She became an alcoholic. And it drove her to the point where she went to Paul Dunlop and said, I can't stand this any longer. I'm going out of my mind. You've always promised me I could go back to my old job. And I can't, you know, I just can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
So they were as good as their word. They released her. She went back to her job. And she'd been back in her old job for 2 weeks when she died. And I know they killed her. The reason I know they killed her was because when I decided that I wanted to run away from all this, it was just too much in the back of my head as a young man. She died when I was 18, I think, or 19, and it's just too much. 2 days before I left, I got an envelope through the door with £2,000 in very old used notes and a little typed message which said, "Don't look back, Whittington." So I had the blood money.
Interesting. Telling you basically to go away on your travels and disappear.
Funnily enough, Simon, you've mentioned the relationship between the NSA and MI5, and as far as we understand it, the MI5 would spy on American citizens and the NSA would spy on British citizens because they have a thing called plausible deniability. And another point about the NSA, we've discovered during our interviews with UFOlogists and researchers, is that they were formed very shortly after the Roswell incident.
Yeah.
I don't know if you were aware of that.
I think it was 2 weeks later.
Were you aware of that, Simon?
I'm sorry.
Was I breaking up?
Just before you said Roswell, you broke up. Just finished the bit before Roswell.
We've discovered through our interviews that the NSA was created shortly after the Roswell incident.
Yeah.
And although they're meant to be the National Security Agency, they always seem to crop up.
We've seen
whenever you speak about UFOs.
A lot of what you're saying makes a lot of sense.
It does.
We've had a lot of guests talking about different elements of what sound like the same story.
Yeah. And also, Simon, I understand it's breaking up because we had a chat before we started recording. Of course, the line was perfect, and since we've started recording, it's dipping in and out, which is another thing that happens whenever you talk about this kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm not going to edit this show, so anybody who's listening to this, I'm going to leave this completely unedited so you can listen to the actual dips that come in.
And Simon, I must say, you're talking about a few things in a bit more detail than I've heard before regarding your grandfather and your mother. Do you feel safe talking about this?
Yeah.
You seem to be revealing a lot of secrets. Do you?
There's been one attempt on my life.
Yeah.
I'll make it absolutely clear, which you may have picked up in the newspapers. The goes down as the car crash. Have you read about that?
No, tell us about it, Simon, please.
I'd put an interesting link on David Icke's website.
Yeah,
we'll see now whether our signal goes down. Now this will be interesting.
Yeah,
I put a link out and I said, "Has anybody seen the reptiles?" And I got a lot of replies back. Some weren't any good and some were interesting, but one particularly stood out. A young woman whose father is a millionaire, who's a prominent Mason and was until recently a governor of a big city, obviously not in Britain. And she came over to have a chat with me. Can you still hear me?
We're still there, Simon. Yep.
Good.
Right. And I don't know if you've heard of the researcher Wynne Keach. Does that ring a bell with you, Winston Keach?
Not sure.
Not with me.
Not sure.
He investigates crop circles.
Ah, right.
He's very, very knowledgeable. He's an ex-RAF pilot, and is someone you really ought to meet. So we had a three-way meeting. I wanted this guy, who doesn't live very far away from me, he only lives about a mile away from where I am, to meet and have a chat. We had a three-way chat. On the way home, driving at 65 miles an hour on the A64 towards Leeds, in Britain, and a black was it not a Vectra? It was I can't remember. But a black car comes shooting up on the left-hand side, and must be nearly 75 miles an hour, and then just turns straight into the left of us, crashes right into where she's sitting on the door. So it's like an undertake, but instead of attempting to undertake, it just goes straight into us. But because I'm a driving instructor,
yes,
and been in Get Out of Skids, I did not allow him to push us into the crash barrier, which was what he was attempting to do. The car was completely written off. My car was worth £8,000 and the damage to it was £10,500. But the fascinating thing is that the car that crashed into us was a company car and its logo was ICU.
Oh.
And if you Google ICU, its parent company is ICU Incorporated, which is an American company which specializes in sweeping for electronic bugs, surveillance, watching people. I'm not saying, and I'm actually categorically not saying that the guy who drove the car deliberately intended to crash into me, but I am saying that he was mind controlled and he did what he was instructed to do. Because what happened was he got straight out of the car, and this is on the police record, because obviously all the emergency services attended because it was a massive crash on that road. He jumped out the car with a bottle of Coke in his hand, and it was just Coke, it wasn't drugs or drink. He came straight up to me. We had to be rescued. This is fascinating as well. I'm sorry it's a bit out of order because this only happened in March and it's still fresh in my mind.
Okay.
This could be coincidence, but when the car crashed, we were on our side in trees and we couldn't get out. We were trapped in the car and I was knocked unconscious for about 10 seconds, nothing longer than that. There were off-duty soldiers, an off-duty doctor and an off-duty nurse that were there within 13 to 15 seconds and got us out the car. That now strikes me as really odd. But the guy came up to me, put his hand on my shoulder, this guy who crashed into me, and said, and I quote, "I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to hit you. I had no choice because of the stuff up ahead." Now, at the time, I was rather shocked. And I'm wondering if what he said to me was, "I'm very sorry, I didn't mean to hit you. I had no choice because of the stuff in my head." So I don't blame him directly. It was a definite attempt. At that speed, it's not a warning. At 65 miles an hour, that's not a warning. That's a definite attempt. But to answer your question, no, because there are forces greater than humanity at play at the moment, for thousands of years. And this particular force, which is off-planet, was not going to let a human agency, it's a human agency that wanted rid of us, to get away with it. So we were protected. So no, I'm not scared because I know that I will be looked after.
You're going to need the protection by all accounts. I don't know if I should even ask this, Simon, but you know the documents you read as a child during 71, 79, was there anything that struck out in your mind, the secret documents in particular? Is it safe to say, or we don't have to go down that avenue?
No, I'm fine. I have no fear. I mean, you know, if I was going to be dead, I'd be dead.
Yeah,
it's not going to happen. The documents were hugely technical. They would be very old, traditional looking blueprints, lots of graphs. It wasn't a political document. It was a sort of paper that scientists would do for argument's sake. This is a funny one. The documents, time and time again, were saying that the scientists couldn't understand how a small reactor in these spaceships, these extraterrestrial craft or interdimensional craft, to give them their correct term, how such a small reactor could give so much power. And this was really, really exercising their minds, because these reactors in these spaceships, you know, they're tiny. You know, you can walk around them very quickly. They're very small. So they got those and they were thinking, all right, what use can we use of them? Because they're miniaturized. So they've been tasked with creating a nuclear reactor that a what's the helicopter with the two rotor blades called? A Chinook.
Chinook, yeah.
The Chinook could lift and take to the battlefield in, say, if Russia was attacking or somewhere, drop this nuclear reactor down, and they could hook it up and have unlimited power. But the scientists said that this just wouldn't work in the battlefield scenario. But you know what we can do with it, they said? We can put it into tunneling machines. We can create tunneling machines which are nuclear-powered. And they said on the document, in 5 years' time, we will be able to make a nuclear reactor the size of a VW, a Volkswagen motor car. And Paul Dunlop put a pencil, because he was always penciling, put a pencil through that, and he said, the Americans won't know what a VW car is. So he said to my mother, just type Mini. He said, they know what Mini is.
Yeah.
So things like that stick out in my mind. But the pure technical stuff, it just went over my head. There was talk of time travel, manipulating the future, manipulating the past from a purely weapons perspective. They wanted to get energy weapons down into handheld guns. The document, and this is back in the 70s, the document said that they'd got not a tank, but like a troop carrying thing. Mm. They'd got beam weapons on that. They were saying that the problem was that the energy required was still so great that you needed a big vehicle. But they were talking about miniaturizing them down into handheld weapons. Lots on mind control. And a lot of ex-Nazi scientists had great knowledge on mind control. And the reason that Joseph Mengele... and this isn't picked up by researchers, so it's a good chance for me now just to put my perspective on it.
Yes.
The reason that Joseph Mengele was, I am Jewish. I'm a Jew, so, I hate the man. Mm. The reason that Mengele was undertaking so many horrendous experiments, not just on Jews, but just on anybody.
Yes.
Not just because of experimentation for experimentation's sake, because in the early to mid 30s, Germany had a UFO crash of its own, and they were trying to create humans who could not be taken over by extraterrestrials. They wanted to be able to have super soldiers, in their words. Mm-hmm. So when extraterrestrial attempted to enter its mind, they could resist that.
So I have read some documentation about Übersoldat.
Right.
Which is exactly word for word what you just said.
Right. So the whole plan was, how can we make our secret safe? But then it developed, because Germany at that time, the scientists were just given free range. I mean, it was just mayhem. They could just do what they wanted, which is fantastic, except in a war situation. You can't do that in a war situation. You just need to find something and knock it out in its millions. But the Germans were very esoteric, and they could go and do what they wanted. So people like Mengele got the brief, but then took it and just ran with it. Mm. And so, of course, when the Americans overran Germany, and they suddenly realized, oh my God, not just look at the technology, but look what's behind it. Mm. That's why they wanted all the and that's why people like Mengele and all those other bastards were accepted by the Americans and the British, because it was better they fall into our hands than they fall into the communist hands.
Simon, I've got two questions for you. One might seem quite obvious to most people, well, maybe to you and to me, but maybe not to everybody, but it sounds to me like... just to put a hypothesis forward, that it sounds like all these dates and ideas and documentations, they all match up very well to an idea of perhaps post-Roswell incident, they have been dismantling aircraft and learning new technologies and farming the components out around the world to their various, you know, satellite agencies. And your mother was basically transcribing elements of this. It kind of fits that. Would you go along with that?
Yes, I would. I mean, I know about Roswell, because my mother would have long discussions with these agents who would come to the flat. Roswell did take place. It wasn't one craft. It was two. and two craft collided above. My mother never called it Roswell, neither did the agents. It wasn't ever called a Roswell crash. It was called the New Mexico crash.
Yeah.
That's how they referred to it. It was never called Roswell. It was a New Mexico crash. And it was two craft that crashed. Mm. But you see, the real key, we haven't got time for this now because we're running out of time, but the real key about Roswell is the Orion cubes. That's what the technology was about, the boxes that the extraterrestrials, the little greys, were carrying.
Yeah,
and they also weren't your typical Hollywood greys with the big wraparound eyes. Mm. These were a different form of grey. Mm-hmm. So, what the Roswell situation did was jumpstart human technology by about 150 years
yes.
in the space of about 2 to 3 years.
Yes. Yeah.
Because my human mother, because we haven't even talked about my...
No.
I don't think we're going to have time. I think we'll have to have you back to talk about the main thing. But
I have a feeling this might be a six-parter, Simon.
What your mother and grandfather were doing and what you've come across yourself, maybe we'll just concentrate on that today, if that's okay.
We'll stick with that. I think we're easily going to fill this.
Yes, fine.
Yeah.
So my mother would never have fiber optics in the house because she said they're alien. She said they're not of this earth.
Yes.
So we used to go past the shop in the 1970s when fiber optic lamps first came out.
Yeah.
And we would stand there, both of us, glued to it, and she would be fascinated by it. But I'd been into the conversations. I'd never spoken, but I would overhear the conversation, so I knew exactly what was going on. We would look at these fiber optics. Very, very briefly, if it's of any interest to you and your listeners, Einstein was a brilliant man, but he was wrong. You can go faster than the speed of light. These spacecraft that had crashed and been recovered, they don't have any wires, because if you're in a spacecraft and as you go towards light velocity, the signals, the electronic signals that you send down a wire cable don't ever reach the computer.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what you have to do is put your encoded signals into pulsed light so that you're already traveling at the speed of light.
Mm.
It allows the computer then to get its information. But because that information is traveling at light speed, it becomes a super, super, super computer and processes much faster. So once the humans understood the nature of the technology they got, this is what caused the American government to bring about the biggest lie that the Earth has ever seen, because they were sitting on something that would put the United States at the top of the pile forever. Mm. And there was no way on God's earth they were going to give that up. So the more they discovered, the more they realized that this is going to give us control over places like Cuba. I mean, the fact that America and Russia don't get on is not true. America and Russia do get on. On a surface level, they don't, and they do have distance. But the reality is, I mean, my grandfather went and met Stalin. I didn't even tell you about that.
Oh, my God.
When the Roswell crash came up, look, Winston Churchill was a member of the Illuminati. The Americans really liked him. He was accepted as one of the key leading figures in the world. So it was the biggest shock on God's earth to the Illuminati when Winston Churchill lost the 1945 general election to Clement Attlee. Mm. Suddenly, the Americans were dealing with a socialist government that wasn't a member of the Illuminati. So what they did was they pulled the plug on contact with Britain, and they wouldn't share at that time any information about Roswell. My grandfather was dispatched, for God's sake, to speak to Joseph Stalin to find Stalin knew about Americans' Roswell. And in 1949, my grandfather met Stalin, and he explained what, you know, and talked. And what Stalin said, and the Americans aren't going to like this, was that give me 7 years and I'll have infiltrated the CIA, and I will know everything. But he refused to tell my grandfather what he knew. And grandfather said he certainly did know an awful lot. And he said he knew more than the British knew. But the funny bit is that because grandfather was saying, have you got any technology? I don't think they called it alien technology. But anyway, have you got any alien technology? And Stalin, who had a translator with him, said, no, I haven't, and kept on refusing to go down that road. But at the end of the meeting, He said to my grandfather, I want to give you a present. So grandfather said, oh, what is it? And he said, well, we don't have any alien technology to give you, Mr. Marsland. That's my grandfather's name, Marsland. Isn't that funny? Yeah, very odd that. And he said, but I'll give you this. And it was a bracelet that a lady would wear. And it had beautiful cut gems on it. And he said, give it to your mistress, being Russian. And my grandfather said, I'm married. So he said, is it? He said, well, it's Alexandrite. And he said it come from the city which was called Alexandrite, named after Princess or Queen Alexandria. And he said that he said it's the nearest thing to alien technology we've got, because under daylight it's blue, but if you take it under a neon light, it turns green just naturally. I think I've got the colours the right way around, but it changes colour and light. Anyway, he said that belonged to the last Tsarina of Russia, who we murdered. And he said, you can give that away. So my grandfather went all over the place trying to talk about alien technology. But it's interesting that he was dispatched to the Russians, because at that time the Americans were not telling the British anything. And that explains also why the TSR-2, the experimental jet aircraft that the British built, which was light years ahead of anything, was stopped. And there was one before that as well. So the Americans have had a very uneasy relationship with Britain, unlike Australia. The Americans and the Australians are the closest allies. Okay, that I think that. Are we running out of time now?
No, we're good.
We're about 10 minutes. But
we don't have to stick to the hour even. We can certainly slide over a little.
Listening to you, Simon, we've interviewed a lot of people about UFOs. We've interviewed on Roswell and the Disclosure Project and, gosh, I've lost track. But talking to you today, you are tying up a lot of loose ends.
A lot.
Are you hearing this?
Very much so, yeah.
I think you're going to be a pivotal kind of person in tying up, in putting the jigsaw together, Simon, actually, with your information, to be honest with you, on the American UFO.
I've seen it, you see. I mean, I was in for what, 7, 8, 9 years in a household that was just living, breathing espionage. My mother asked her handler, because that's what poor Dunlop was, her handler, why me? Because she went through, you know, all humans go through a phase, don't they? And it was like, why me? Why have you asked me? And his answer to her made her just not faint, but she just collapsed on the sofa. He said to her, you're the only person in Britain who can do this. She thought, my God, because she thought, well, you know, we've lived in Brighton, which is 52 miles south of London. She thought, my God, there must be somebody in London who could do this. And he said, no, you're the only person in Britain who can do this. You've been chosen to do this work. And it was the weight of the responsibility. And whenever she'd meet these agents, they would be captain this or colonel this. The lowest rank that she ever met was a captain, and the highest rank she ever met was, I think, a full colonel. And they were all members of the British intelligence, either MI5 or MI6, all ex or serving military men or ex-RAF. Paul Dunlop was an RAF pilot, and he used to fly Lightnings.
Oh.
And when Mum used to go out and make a coffee, he would tell me stories about airplanes, and we would put two chairs together on the floor, and he would pretend to be the pilot. He would sit at the front, and I would be, he said, you'll be my radio man. And our best game that we used to play while Mum was making the coffee was chase the UFO. That was one. And the second game was ground support. And he would give me a running commentary, you know, jinx this way, and, you know, give me this, give me that. And I didn't have a dad, you see, because my dad had disappeared when I was about 1 year old. I think these guys sort of felt a bit paternal for me in a way. But again, talk to researchers now. They say this is highly unusual for men who are dealing in death, basically. They're MI5, MI6 officers to be interacting with you in this way.
Yeah.
And they must know, they must have known that you, that's me, were going to have some form of contact with extraterrestrials, because they are grooming you in a way. They are dropping. They're watching over you.
They're normalizing the whole thing. Do you think your mother could have been selected when they said she was the only one in Britain? Could it have been a biological basis? Because, I mean, really, there are lots of people with similar qualifications, I'm sure, you know, as she said herself, but could it literally have been down to some sort of biological selection?
Was it the grandfather's, the father's yeah. involvement in the...
I think you're both right. I think I know for a fact that my mother's blood, she was AB rhesus negative.
Ah.
And I understand there's only 1 or 2% of the whole world's population
yeah.
that are AB rhesus negative. My human biological father was rhesus positive. My father was, don't say Iranian, my father was Persian. He was from Persia, mm-hmm. and he was a Persian Jew. And my mother had wanted to get pregnant by him, and he'd said, no, you can't unless you convert to the Jewish faith. So she converted to Jews, and I was born. So biologically, it's interesting on the bloodline there. Yes, I'm sure that my grandfather's position ensured that they knew that she'd come from a very reliable background.
I have heard stories, I don't know if you're familiar with this, whereby you would have a rhesus negative parent and a positive parent, and the baby would be attacked by the inappropriate blood in the womb. I'm not sure if you've heard of that before.
What my mother was told was that she could never have more than one child, because if she did, both her and the child would die.
Yeah.
To which she replied, well, I only want this one child. So... I just throw that in because I didn't pick this up. It's only recently, the last 2 years, that researchers have said, oh, do you know the things about that? And I didn't.
Yeah.
Then it just strikes me as interesting, and it's worth throwing in. So mother was very unwilling into working for MI5, but I will say this, she was extremely loyal. She never discussed it with anybody. And then I know we're nearly running out of time, but I mean, when I had my first really big UFO experience, again in 1971, not long after she just joined MI5, within a matter of weeks, she was the only one who didn't laugh when I told her what I'd seen. She was the only one who took it at face value and just nodded her head, basically. She also, when I was a young boy, she used to cut out the clippings from the local newspaper that was serializing von Daniken's book.
Yeah.
And she took me to see things like 2001 A Space Odyssey. And she used to say to me, you've got to watch this. So she never, looking back now, you know, Mark, she never sat down and said, yes, it's all true. But what she did was throw me crumbs or throw me a line and say, follow that and see where it takes you.
Wow.
Well, your mother, when you think about it, I mean, she signed the Official Secrets Act, and then the next thing she knew, she was translating stuff, and her reality was turned upside down for her, for an ordinary lady. I mean, she was discovering that UFO...
I assume she was discovering this as she read it.
Yeah. I mean, it must have been mind-blowing.
Well, she said to Paul Dunlop, the government's lying to me. The government's been lying.
Mm.
And do you know what Paul Dunlop replied? He said, you're part of the government now, so you're lying to people.
Oh, that tactic, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you're in now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Grief. Going back to something you said earlier about the Nazi technology, I've often put forward a question which I've never really had a satisfactory answer to, and that is, why were the Nazis so far ahead of everybody else during World War II? I mean, they had stuff we could only dream of. We were very innovative, but they were more innovative. And what you're saying,
according to the records, they had a UFO crash.
Yeah,
before Roswell, pre-Roswell,
because that would then explain why they were so far in front.
Partly. You're breaking up again a little bit. So if I suddenly disappeared, let me know.
Yeah.
No, that's not quite the answer. You're partly there, but it's a bit more complicated than that. The reason that Germany, let's look at it this way, the reasons that Nazis lost the war was because of the UFO crash. Now I'm going to explain that.
Ah.
When the UFO crashed in Germany, they spent all their time not on the nuclear reactor, which, had they done that, they would have been well ahead. But they wanted to know about the Vril They wanted to know about what made that thing fly without an engine. So two things they went down the road of. One was trying to miniaturize circuits because they had a very rudimentary grasp, and they half created the transistor, half created it. But they didn't really understand what the hell they were doing. And they didn't go down the American route, because the Americans had their own crash, you know, and that's where their bomb came from, the understanding of that, because they just looked at the reactor from their own crash craft. Mm. So the Americans looked at that. But what people don't realize, and again, this is only what I've overheard in conversations, so I mean, it could be wrong, couldn't it? Yeah. But Americans were able to refine, I always get confused with uranium and plutonium, but they were able to refine the stuff they needed to make the bomb explode. Mm. But they didn't have the technology to create the electronic trigger mechanism.
Right.
Because when they got their crash craft, instead of looking at the circuitry side of it, you know, they were doing have I got this the right way around? No, I'm sorry, I've got it the wrong way around. It's so confusing. The Germans had actually refined the plutonium or the uranium.
Yeah.
But they couldn't explode it. The Americans had got something. And so what happened, from what Paul Dunlop said, was that a German submarine on its way to Iceland, mm-hmm. was intercepted by an American group force. And instead of being depth charged and, you know, sunk, the crew surrendered. But inside the submarine was like uranium or plutonium. I can't remember which one it was now, but it was with that. And so the Americans were actually able to use that. So the bomb that was dropped on Japan, its uranium came from Germany. Don't know that.
That's interesting.
Because what was happening was that the Americans and the Germans, who'd each had a crashed craft, were looking at specific elements of it, but they weren't joined up.
Right. So they both had a pre-Roswell crash some years before. That's interesting news.
I'd overheard, absolutely, and they were quite clear about this when they were talking about it. But the point was that it was the reason that Roswell was so important. It was after the war, so there wasn't the focus of the war anymore. Mm. But so many people in New Mexico knew about it that it was going to come out, and that's why they had to put that cover story of, you know, flying saucer found, to send everybody looking in the wrong direction. So the difference was that the Germans were looking at one end of it, the Americans the other end, and the Germans were just running away with their ideas on this thing. They said Hitler wanted, this is the secret weapon, all this crap about the V2 was the secret weapon, the wonder weapon. Of course it wasn't that. It was looking at time travel. They'd understood the ability to go from one dimension into another dimension. They were experimenting with that. They were experimenting with what made these flying discs actually come off the ground. That's where their attention was. And had they done what the Americans were doing, which was the bread and butter stuff, they would have then not been so advanced in say, I mean, the Germans had the first guided missile, for God's sake. Mm. Instead of all that, if they just concentrated on a few elements, they would actually have won the war. There's no question of that. And that's why the Americans were so desperate to capture certain parts of Germany, where these factories or where these key scientists lived.
Just one last question, Simon. I think we're probably going to have to get you back again. Do you think that the fact that these two nations, who both have, let's say, imperialistic tendencies, managed to get hold of some alien technology, gave them a hell of a boost in technology terms, could that have even been the catalyst for World War II? Could that have even been, because all of a sudden they're able to do things they couldn't do before, could that even have been the cause?
Adolf Hitler was always going to have a war. That was preordained. That was always going to happen. Mm. But what you're sort of there, let's put it this way, the odds were balanced up. The odds were evened out.
Yeah.
So you see, if nobody, alien or human, wants this Earth destroyed, that's not what it's about. They don't want the Earth destroyed. And had Hitler run away unbridled, he would have, you know, he would have actually been a hindrance to them. So they evened it up. They gave some technology to America and evened the balance.
Certainly, yeah.
Simon, I think what we ought to do is, by the way, you have been, when we speak to anybody in the UK, the technology is fine. We never have a breakup. We never have a dip. It's always very clear. You've been you've been breaking up all the way along. We're going to post it up the
it's
way
only,
it is.
Yeah, we're going to do a pro live. It's only been very mild, but it's been there.
And I think we probably want to get this bit of information up on iTunes as quickly as possible before anything happens to it. We'll have to call it a day there. We haven't even got on to the subject that you came on to talk to us about.
Isn't that terrible? I want to talk about reptilians, and I want to talk about mantids and the feline species and little greys. Oh, well.
Simon, what we're going to do is we're going to call this part one, and we'll have a word with you when we've finished, and we'll get another time off you, and we'll try and get this done sooner rather than later, and we'll get them all done.
Actually, Simon, I think it was pretty important to get that bit out there, because I haven't heard this from you before, and I think it's pretty vital stuff.
That's fine. I mean, I'm self-employed, so if you want to sort of pull up another interview very quickly, I can do that.
I think we will,
because
maybe next week or something like
but
that.
But I think it was good to get that out of the way, because it explains a lot about you as a man. And
it's worth talking about.
It is worth talking about.
The background alone is, and it also ties up a lot of other bits of research and stories you hear.
It does, very much so. That's
more so than most people would realise.
You're a big piece of the jigsaw, Simon, that's all I can say.
Okay.
Simon, are you going to the Exopolitics conference? Did I hear that you were talking there?
In February? I've been asked to talk, yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, wherever that is, I imagine it's going to be well worth it.
It's been Liverpool.
Yeah. Oh, it's the Liverpool one, but for next year. That's going to be a hell of an event for anybody to attend, because I don't know how much time they're going to give you, but it's going to be well worth it.
They offered me an hour, and I said, that's not enough.
It's not.
So we managed to negotiate an hour and a half. But I'm speaking this year at a MASH have organised a conference at the end of August, beginning of September in Nottingham.
Oh, brilliant.
And I'm speaking there as well. That's at the Britannia Hotel in Nottingham.
Brilliant.
Well, I've watched the videos from a MASH, and unlike a lot of stuff that I've looked at over the years, they're all like you, Simon. They're very logical. Very plausible, very rational people.
They're the kind of people who would get selected for good witnesses or for jury duty. They're believable, plausible people.
Yeah, it resonates with me. When I listen to you.
Okay, you're breaking up.
Simon,
thank you for coming on. Let's
wrap it up and get this put away safely and up on iTunes before anything happens to it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming on, Simon.
Okay.
And let's do it again as soon as we can.
Yeah, I'm up for it, you know, so whenever you want, just give me a shout.
Oh, superb. Thanks so much, Simon.
Thanks a million.
Okay. Thanks for that. You take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Simon.
You look after yourself.
Bye-bye. Bye. Wow.
groundbreaking.
Yeah. I must admit, I have listened to some of Simon's interviews before, and I know he has a lot of detail. And
this is the thing, Mark.
But I must admit, the ones I've all heard about, they've been talking about his UFO stroke alien experiences.
Yeah.
That I've not heard before.
No, me neither. I just wonder, should we get this up very quickly, maybe put it ahead?
We might well do
that. I don't want anything to happen to it, because there's stuff in there that needs to get out.
Yeah, yeah. We'll probably bump something and get that up there.
As I say, you and I, we've done a lot of looking into history and secret services, secret societies, but this seems to be...
He's tying a lot of stuff together there.
Yeah.
He's tying... he didn't even get onto the satanic mason type stuff.
But
the Nazi stuff kind of ties in with Gerard Williams...
Oh, it
going
does.
Right back to that far back. The other stuff all ties up.
The UFO people we speak to, they seem to have a lot of it, but they don't have enough. And he just seems to have the other slot, the other piece that's missing.
Yeah.
I hope he meets up with the American guys and they put their heads together. And I think we're in for some revelations is what I think. And I think it started here.
I can't wait to get him back on.
I think you heard it here first on the Out There Hour.
Yes, I think you might have.
At Alternative Future Radio. And I can't stress enough, this is a vital...
Yes.
Interview.
And this interview is not going to be edited in any way. So if there are drops and peaks and troughs, it was there for a purpose. So don't complain.
Yeah, it's not our line. Something's going on there.
Yeah, I thought I'd leave it in because it is very, very specific sometimes. literally, when we were talking to Nick Redfern and to Aaron Hansen.
Aaron Hansen.
It was literally down to the sentence.
I think even Mac Maloney, the author on Wartime UFOs, I think even he dropped here and there.
Yeah, very strange.
And he's
business.
Been talking about his line. He's written 40 science fiction books, the first factual book on UFOs. Now he's suddenly having line problems.
Very strange. Landlines as well, not mobiles, but landlines, which are pretty bomb-proof.
Tune in next time for the part two of Simon Parks. You're not going to want to miss this.
I don't. And I'm in it.
You're listening to Alternative Future Radio, home of the weird, resting place of the paranormal. We'll take you to the furthest reaches of the galaxy and beyond. Strange phenomena, aliens, psychics, cryptozoology, conspiracy, holistic health, and UFOs. Alternative Future Radio, where spooky just got weird.